Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
And so
hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to learn about tea drinkers living longer lives. Who says? The Chinese Academy of Medical Sciences published in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology. That's right, drinking tea every day is associated with a lower risk of cardiovascular disease and all causes of death. 100,000 people participated in this particular heart disease study. We're going to go into it and a lot more on health and healing. Then we're going to take a look at what Medea Benjamin, who's going to appear on our program live today from Washington, D.C., has to say about the impact of the assassination of General Soleimani and recent U.S. aggression had on Iranians. She's been to Iran. She's interviewed people at all stages. She was not censored. She was allowed to go where she wanted to go. And that's important because all the people on CNN and Fox who are pro-war, and by the way, they're both pro-war, they're both inviting military people on, who represent the military-industrial complex, but they don't represent the Iranian people. We don't have that perspective. Today we will. Also today, we're going to hear from Chris Hedges. Chris is one of that group of a band of brothers and sisters. There are about, I'm guessing, around 300 more or less of us in the United States who are at the front lines of doing the original investigative reporting, bringing the challenge to those who are aligned with the special interest groups. We challenge them, and we work together. We offer platforms. Chris has been in many of our documentaries, and so we're giving him a forum today to talk about something that needs to be better understood, the miracle of kindness. When I watched the impeachment proceedings, I didn't see kindness. I saw ideology on steroids. I don't see people working to understand what it means to be kind to those with less or nothing. I would have thought at the Golden Globes, with Ricky giving excoriating a statement about these people's sense of entitlement. And I've spent enough time in Hollywood, have enough friends who are power players in the field, the top publicist, Neil Koningsberg, a longtime friend of mine, 50 years he's been my friend, and Neil Koningsberg and Lansky, one of the most important management public relations firms in the history of Hollywood. So I get stuff firsthand. I get to see it, one of my friend's top producers. And I see the spoiled, petulant, insecure brats that most of these people are. Not all. You have some, you know, Woody Harrelson. He's a person who cares about environmentalism, freedom of choice. He's a vegan. Mark Ruffalo. In fact, Mark said hello on the street and we had an hour conversation. He is a thespian, yes, but he's a consumer advocate first. A real mensch. There are those people who have stood up on principle, even when it went against the people that they were employed by or the people they work with. So what didn't I see at the Golden Globes? What didn't I see at the Oscars? What didn't I see at the Emmys? I don't see kindness towards those who have left. Imagine this. I was just thinking about this morning. Imagine that if someone got up, won an award, doesn't matter for what, and in their acceptance speech, instead of thanking everybody, their agent, and they simply said, you know what we should all do? We are all gifted at this point in our life. We're here. Why don't we leave here instead of going to a party and talking about ourselves and showing our latest outfits from designers that cost us thousands of dollars? Why don't we go home, change our clothes, go out on the street, and find homeless people who are working, not drug addicts, not alcoholics, not those with mental conditions. They have to be helped, but not by you directly. Here, you can directly help people. Take that person that's now sleeping in their car, has no bathroom to go to, has to go through hoops each day to go to work, but not earning enough money. Why don't you go to that person, hear their story, listen to what they have to say, see how they got to where they are, see how they're living. How do you put all your clothes and your personal items into a car or a van? And what happens when the neighborhood doesn't want you here? What happens when the police say to move on or give you a ticket you can't afford? Why don't you take that person to a motel and rent them a room for 3 months? And then on a regular basis, communicate with them and see if there's something you can do with your position and your power and your privilege to help that person take a step up in life. At least they would have a place where they could go from work to a place where they can lay down on a bed, they can take a shower. You take it for granted when you want to go to the bathroom in privacy and take whatever time you want. You can take as long a shower as you want. You can go to the refrigerator, open it up, and whatever you want to eat, it's there. You can take your time and make yourself a quick meal or a long, wonderful meal. They can't. They're frequently eating out of cans or food that they were able to buy and take to a car. And how much money is there to buy something? And say, let us all forget the importance of ourselves and look at the significance of others. That is one of the meanings of life. What greater value could you have as a human being than to be in service to others who have less and to share the importance of maintaining the common for all? That's not the society we live in, but it is the world that Chris Hedges lives in, and Abby Martin lives in, and Glenn Ford and Ellie Bay lives in, and Paul Craig Roberts, and Gerald Salante. And again, about that I personally know, about 300. I know there's more, and I don't want to leave anyone out. I'm just talking about the people who you can regularly expect to take on any injustice, like Medea Benjamin, and make a sacrifice getting arrested and being attacked for it, or a Chelsea Manning. We need more people to join that band of warrior healer brothers and sisters. So we're going to hear from Chris Hedges today. 7 minute clip, The Miracle of Kindness. I think it was very inspiring. We're also going to hear today from how the neocons are manufacturing the crisis that we're now faced with, Garth Porter. Wonderful mind. And if time permits today, there was public testimony by airline pilots and medical doctors and scientists. Those are the only people, no lay people, talking about chemtrails and what we're exposed to and why this group is not paying attention, why the federal government is denying it or lying about it. And these people are all under oath, and they all came forward. They all had short statements. We can't play all of it. We'll play some of it today, because we believe until we acknowledge a problem exists, we cannot change it. So that's what we're going to do today. I have another short piece from Helen, the investigative journalist. Piece by piece, we are deconstructing the legitimacy of Wikipedia. We've already deconstructed Stephen Barrett. We've already deconstructed the editors, the anonymous editors, who we now know who they really are. We've deconstructed their information by reviewing tens of thousands of peer-reviewed articles showing that what they're saying is not true. We deconstructed the legitimacy of their statements by showing they're illegitimate, biased, and we've deconstructed their pay-to-play, editors getting money and then writing favorably about someone or writing harshly about someone, having nothing to do with the truth. None of this is what a real encyclopedia, but Wikipedia, in my opinion, is not a real encyclopedia. There's nothing about it I would trust or believe or anyone associated with it. But now we are specifically exposing every board member, every officer, Jimmy Wells' wife. Yeah, Jimmy, we're going to show everything about Wikipedia and you specifically, Jimmy, but yours is going to be last. The next time you think about destroying people's reputations and calling those of us who believe in healing the people as naturally as possible, quote, lunatic charlatans, make sure that you don't pick on someone who is a multi-award-winning investigative journalist who's broken more stories than any of their journalists in American history. That's me, Jimmy. You think we're going to let you get away with this? Then you have no idea what you're up against. But hey, you're one of those people from Silicon Valley in San Francisco, and we know what they are like and their attitude of eliteness. Indomitable? Maybe today. But remember, Richard Nixon was the most powerful person on the planet one day, and standing on the steps of the helicopter with his hands raised in a V signal, completely disgraced the next. We'll see. So the challenge is on, Jimmy. We the people in the health movement, we few hundred thousand, we few hundred million patient visits, we hundreds of thousands of articles in the peer-reviewed literature, we are in your face, Buster, and everyone else associated with you. There's not a single person working in a important position with Wikimedia Foundation, any of its other foundations, and the editors. And by the way, the editors, a suggestion, lawyer up, because we have and we'll be announcing in the very near future the lawsuits that are coming. Many. Why do you think I've been hiring lawyers? Specialists. And you thought you were all protected. You're not, as you will see. Read The Art of War. Get an idea what's coming at you. Now, let's go to the latest on health and healing. By the way, just think of how many people may have died because when their orthodox therapy failed them and there was nothing else their doctor said could be done, and they were probably right from their perspective, they did the best they could, then the person gives up. And someone says, but hold on, I heard that a Nicholas Gonzalez or Stanislaw Brzezinski or one of these other doctors working with terminal cancer had some good results. And you think, great, there's a chance. You go to Wikipedia. No, it's all quackery. All quackery. Don't believe any of that stuff. And so you don't. So you just accept it. And you die. Should they be held morally accountable for that? Does that in its collective represent a crime against humanity? These are the issues that we're going to be exploring. And if people think there's not going to be a congressional hearing on this and state and federal investigations, think again. Tea drinkers live longer, said the top of the show. In fact, if you just drank green tea 3 times a week, it's linked with a longer and healthier life. That's according to a study published in the European Society of Cardiology. Quote, habitual tea consumption is associated with lower risks of cardiovascular disease and all-cause death. And this is from the Chinese Academy of Medical Sciences. That's equivalent to our National Academy of Sciences. And they studied 100,902 people in the China cardiovascular study that had no history of heart attack, stroke, or cancer. And those who drank tea 3 or more times a week and those who never drank tea, and then they followed it up for an additional 7.3 years, and those who drank the most tea lived the longest lives, had the healthiest heart, And that's terrific. So, something good. Harvard School of Public Health, Erasmus Medical Center in the Netherlands, and Hong Kong University in China took a look at healthy habits when you're in your middle age years. Now, mind you, that's very subjective. Today, a millennial will hit their middle years if they've lived the typical millennial lifestyle with lots of stress, low physical activity, not a lot of green time, poor diet, binge drinking in college, and a lot of depression or anxiety. You're going to hit middle age about 30. Historically, it was around 40. We made gains in the 1980s and 90s till it went up to around 40, 42. Now it's back down again. Our life expectancy is no longer high. It's dropping. In fact, our life expectancy in the United States for men and women is dropping faster than any other civilized, or not civilized, but any other what we call first or leading developed nation, the more advanced nations like Great Britain and Germany. All the rest are increasing their lifespan, and we're decreasing it. So we're doing a lot of collective wrong, and we refuse to acknowledge it, and we refuse to change it. Individuals are changing, absolutely, but the average person is not. But if you are eating healthy, if you're making healthy habits, according to the British Medical Journal study, sticking with a very healthy lifestyle, not being overweight, and eating a good plant-based diet, you can live a longer life, and especially now from 50 on, you're going to be free of major diseases, cancer, heart disease, diabetes. How about that? In fact, the number of extra disease-free years for men, it's almost 8, and for women, it's 10 years. As you grow older, you can reasonably expect to have no diseases. That's terrific. And so all the more reason we should get on a healthy protocol and stick with it. Also from Jikai University School of Medicine in Japan, published in the Peer Journal of Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers, and Prevention, the analysis suggests that vitamin D can improve survival in P53-positive digestive tract cancers. That's a hard cancer to deal with. And the tumor protein P53 is the gene that is the most frequently mutated among all cancers and is considered the guardian of the genome due to its tumor suppressor effects. But vitamin D can help you. And that's only with 2,000 units a day. That's the low end. They actually measured placebo with 2,000 units a day, and there was a substantial improvement. And so that's important. Something simple, vitamin D. And passion flowers aren't just pretty ornaments. They're also cancer busters. Now, the Federal University of Ceará in Brazil, published in the Journal of Medicinal Plant Research, showed that it is highly cytotoxic to colon cancer, ovarian cancer, and leukemia cell lines, but completely safe for all other cells. That's the ideal chemotherapy, a natural one. Of the 14 species included in the study, they found that the plant Passiflora, that's Passiflora, Alata, also known as the winged stem passionflower, is rich in flavonoids with anti-cancer activity. And these compounds provided enormous cytotoxic power to kill cancer cells, especially the HL60. And so that's good. Again, something else that helps us. How does learning change the brain? It does. Thomas Jefferson University came up with a study on this, and I'll just break it down into its bottom line. All learning programs your brain. In effect, it's nature's way to increase simultaneously both hardwire and software of the brain. Neuroscientists have long known that learning experiences change the functional circuitry that is used to process and remember given learning events. the circuit change is anatomical. Electron microscope photographs reveal that the synoptic changes take the form of little blebs located in dendrites. And these blebs are called dendritic spines, and their size and number changes in response to learning and memory formation. So you might think of the induced change as a physical location for information storage. What is stored in any given spine is an increase in the probability that the spine will participate in activations that generate recall of the stored memory from all the spines that were enhanced in creative memory. And functionally, the changes operate as a template that resides more or less permanently and is available not only to recall the original learning event, but to respond to similar events in the future. That is one reason why every day of our lives we should do something that enhances memory, study something, read a nonfiction book, learn a language, learn a word and a new usage of a word, you know, that you didn't have before. All of this enhances this into our brain, which means that the older you get, the more functionality your brain has. It's when we stop critical thinking, stop learning, stop writing, stop listening to classical music, stop composing, stop doing art, stop doing creative gardening, stop using our mind in constructive ways where we become passive, where everything is done for us. That is when our brain also changes and we lose a lot of our gray matter and we lose memory, we lose cognition. So we have to go from a passive spectator way of living to one where we're constantly searching and curious, just like little kids that love to take everything apart where they can put it back together. Again, it's the fun taking apart, see how things work. We should never lose that curiosity. Also, Northwestern University found that that exercise of the face could take 3 years off your aging faces. A 30-minute daily facial exercise program sustained for 20 weeks improved the facial appearance of middle-aged women, resulting in a younger appearance with fuller upper and lower cheeks. And that was important. And this was actually published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Dermatology. It's the first scientific study to test the premise of facial exercise improving appearance. Now, rather than go into this now, I'm going to do a whole hour on this coming up and about how we can de-age different parts of our body, including growing hair, better skin, nails. I'm going to do all that. I just want to let you know it is possible. And now that's a scientific study, because as you age, the skin loses elasticity and the fat pads between the muscle and the skin become thinner. And the fat pads, which fit together like a jigsaw puzzle, give the face much of its shape. And as skin becomes saggy, the thinning fat pads atrophy and slide, causing that kind of jowly fall-down look. But if the muscle underneath becomes bigger, the skin has more stuffing underneath it, and the firmer muscle appears to make the shape of the face more full. So I'll get into that and show you how we can do that. And also, from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center comes a brand new study that proper exercise can reverse damage from heart aging. That's right. Exercise can reverse damage to sedentary, aging hearts and help prevent risk of future heart failure. If it's enough exercise, and if it's begun in time, and it can really help you. So I'll be going into greater information on what are the best exercises, how you should do them, how long it should take. Oh, and by the way, I won't get into it today. I'll get into it tomorrow. But the Chittaranjang National Cancer Institute in India, major institute there, published an article in the Asian Pacific Journal of Cancer Prevention that there's a natural herbal human papillomavirus cure discovered. A groundbreaking study published in the Asian Pacific Journal of Cancer Prevention just now. Quote, clearance of cervical human papillomavirus infected by topical application of curcumin and curcumin-containing polyphenol cream, a phase 2 randomized a controlled study reveals that vaccination and watchful waiting are not the only recourse for human papilloma infection. The study is believed to be the first of its kind to find an effective and safe therapeutic intervention for the clearance of established cervical human papillomavirus, the HPV virus. Moreover, the study confirmed that the human papillomavirus infection is self-limiting and clears on its own in 73.3% of the untreated placebo group within 37 days. But it was curcumin, AMLA, A-M-L-A, and aloe vera that was used to help. These are all rich in polyphenols as a vaginal cream. How about that? That's really good news. Well, that's what we like to do, empower people with good news and challenge that there's ways of dealing with bad news. Now, we're going to take a break, and when we come back from the break, we're going to go directly to Chris Hedges. And again, this is his personal experience, but it's also something that reminds us what would be different if we learned to understand what it is to be the other, what it is to learn how they live, how they think, their methods of communicating. What is it like to be in their shoes? And do you think that we would be as narcissistic, as selfish, as self-absorbed as a society if we would spend time for 1 week with a family in Yemen? If we would go to someplace else in the world, to where in Nicaragua, or any of the other Central American and South American countries where the weather has devastated them and they can't grow crops and they have no choice but to migrate, but they're terrified what will happen if their family is separated at the border by a president who is insensitive? What would it be like if you were to spend a week with them to see their reality? Would you change your perception? I'll bet you would, because most people are decent people. Most people want to do the right thing. It's just the conditioning that is so intemperate to our spiritual awareness. Back in a moment with Chris Hedges. Please stay with us.
Days a week with my Palestinian professor, Omar Atman, in Jerusalem. We met in my house on Mount Scopus, overlooking the old city every morning. He would arrive with his books and something from his garden, olives, peaches, apricots, or a bag of pistachios. He would patiently unshell as we worked, and then push towards me. Yom fil mishmish, we would say, as we ate his apricots, literally meaning, tomorrow will be good times, and we will eat apricots. But given the long tragedy that has befallen the Palestinians, this phrase is converted into a wistful, tomorrow will never come. Omar, a polyglot who spoke German, Hebrew, and English fluently, and who had worked as a teacher in the court of King Hussein in Jordan, was determined I would not only learn Arabic, but the politesse and formalities of Palestinian society. He drilled into me what to say when someone offered me food, Islamu ideik, may God bless your hands, or when a woman entered the room, and now al bayt, you light up the house, or when someone brought me a small cup of sugary Arabic coffee, kahwe daime, a phrase that meant, may we always drink coffee together in an occasion like this. Omar had a fondness for the Lebanese child singer Remy Bondeli, a fondness I did not share, but on his insistence, I memorized the lyrics to several of her songs. He told long, involved, shaggy dog jokes in Arabic and made me commit them to memory, although sometimes the humor was lost on me. It was armed with this cultural and linguistic fluency that I first reported from Gaza, carefully removing my shoes before entering the cramped, concrete hovels in Palestinian refugee camps, hovels that on the inside were always immaculately clean, When a plate of rice or coffee was brought to me, I responded with the politesse Omar taught me. The fact that I had taken the time to learn to be polite melted even the most suspicious of hearts. It immediately opened the door to friendships that would last years. In March of 1991, I was in Basra, Iraq, during the Shiite uprising as a reporter for the New York Times. I had entered Kuwait with the Marine Corps and then left them behind to cover the fighting in Basra. I was taken prisoner by the Iraqi Republican Guard, who in the chaos, whole army units had defected to join the rebels, had ripped their Republican Guard patches off their uniforms so as not to be identified with the regime of Saddam Hussein. I was studiously polite because of Omar with my interrogators. I swiftly struck up conversations with my guards. My facility in Arabic rendered me human. And when I ran out of things to say, I told the long, shaggy dog jokes taught to me by Omar. Perhaps it was my accented Arabic, but my guards found these jokes unfailingly amusing. I spent a week as a prisoner. I slept and ate with Iraqi soldiers, developed friendships with some, including the major who commanded the unit. And there were several moments when, trapped in heavy fighting with the rebels, they shielded and protected me. One afternoon in the driving rain, I was seated in a Pajero Jeep, hot-wired and stolen by my Iraqi captors during the frantic flight from Kuwait City. We had stopped to fill our canteens from muddy puddles. All of the water purification plants had been bombed. The muck and rainwater had already turned my own guts inside out. As I made my way to the brackish pools, I noticed a woman and two small children scooping up their hands to drink. I knew what the foul water would do to these innocents. And in the cold downpour, recited W.H. Auden's epitaph on a tyrant as a kind of quiet, unintelligible blessing. Perfection of a kind was what he was after. And the poetry he invented was easy to understand. He knew human folly like the back of his hand and was greatly interested in armies and fleets. When he laughed, respectable senators burst with laughter. And when he cried, the little children died in the streets. I would hear the Iraqi soldiers whisper at night about what would happen to me once I was turned over to the secret police or Muhabarat, something they and I knew was inevitable and dreaded. That day came. I was flown on a helicopter to Baghdad and handed to the Muhabarat, whose dead eyes and cold demeanor reminded me of the East German Stasi. There was no bantering now. I was manhandled and pushed forcefully into a room and left there without food or water for 24 hours. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. I awoke the next day to the plaintive call to prayer, the Athan, as the first pale light crept over the city. God is greater, there is no God but Allah. Muhammad is the messenger of God. I went to the window and saw the heavily armed guards in the courtyard below. I did not know if I would live or die. At dawn, the women and often children climbed to the flat roofs in Baghdad to bake bread in rounded clay ovens. I was famished. I called out in Arabic to these women, "I am an American journalist. I am a captive. I have not eaten." A mother handed fresh bread to her young son, who scampered across the roofs to feed me. A few hours later, I was turned over to the International Committee for the Red Cross and driven to Jordan and freedom. Where are they now, these men and women who showed me such compassion, who ignored the role my own country had played in their oppression, to see me as one of them? How can I repay this solidarity and empathy? How can I live to be like them? I owe Omar, I owe all these people, some of whom I did not know, the miracle of human kindness and my life. I am Chris Hedges for the Amir Steiners.
Thoughtful allows us to take a step back and see something in a more enlightened perspective. For those who have engaged in the suppression of free speech, thinking that you're right, that you don't want someone you disagree with having any form, anywhere. Imagine what happens when the day comes when you're not allowed to have free speech. Chris Hedges, you cannot find, along with about 500 other journalists, anywhere on Google or Facebook. Their free speech has been censored. You cannot hear any of the millions of women and men whose children or themselves have been injured by vaccines. You cannot see them in a story in the New York Times or CNN because they've been censored. You cannot understand what it is to be a medical doctor, knowing that if you dare try to cure a patient or even treat them with something that's natural, non-toxic, you could risk your medical license. So you do so in trepidation and fear, surreptitiously, quietly, below the radar, and seeing your patients get well before you never saw that. Think of identity politics. Do you remember the young boy, teenager, who stood silently where he was ridiculed and mocked by the entire left media, made to look as if he was some kind of redneck racist? He was not. CNN just got the word yesterday they had to give him a huge check, probably more than he'll make in an entire lifetime, because they were wrong. Will it change their attitude? Not at all. Did anyone apologize? Unfortunately, people who are tied to the need to be right never know the words "I'm sorry." They don't know how to seek forgiveness nor to offer forgiveness. There is no kindness in their demeanor nor in their philosophy of others. Identity politics has ripped this country apart. The very important issues, the ones de-ghettoizing, feeding hungry children, finding homes for the homeless, helping people who are working a job or two jobs or three jobs and still can't pay their bills, of stopping wars, cleaning up our environment, the real important, getting money out of politics, none of that is being addressed. None of it. The second or third or completely unimportant issues are all that's the focus right now. I once saw, I believe it was on Discovery, that was talking about the Big Bang that caused the Earth to go into an extinction period, thought by most to be a meteorite. Two dinosaurs were shown in this particular animation of still fighting as the lava was approaching them. They were so absorbed in hating each other, fearing each other, that both lost their lives. That's where we're at today with our identity politics, our neoliberal, our warped perceptions. We're going to show one more clip, and then we're going to go to Medea Benjamin, our guest, because this is also important. That we hear what, we hear what these pilots and scientists and doctors are saying under oath before a committee, because this information is not covered by the mainstream media. Chemtrails.
To when you go outside on a cold day and exhale, you create a condensation trail. That little cloud is a condensation trail. Now, if you take a 2-mile walk on a cold day and you can turn around and you can see your condensation trail tracking all the way back for 2 miles. That's how crazy it is to think that what we're looking in the sky is actually condensation trails.
The contrails, not the chemical, the contrails occur because of cold air, minus 30. It takes a high altitude, around 30,000 feet plus. There's a carbon dioxide and water vapor in that exhaust. That turns to ice crystals, and that's what you see, the white stream behind it. Those white crystals of ice warm up, dissolve, and the smoke goes away. And it never lasts more than a minute. What we're seeing now, and I first could not believe it, and I started looking at the skies, and these are not normal. They're not natural. There's something going on. I don't know who it is or why they're doing it. All I can testify is it's not natural and it's not normal. It's got to be some outside influence doing that. Thank you.
I'm here to give you testimony that chemtrails, they're not contrails, are indeed real. They're spraying almost every day. I watch the clouds and watch the spraying program going on. I want to tell you that we're in very great danger from the pollution that's coming down over us. And we've been led astray by the military-industrial complex, and they're responsible for the clouds' creation and weather manipulation programs. They're dark operations. That's why they're not out in the media.
I look around and I see people are starting to look up and see this. Many times I've spoken about chemtrails, and I get this blank look on my face. What are you talking about? I'm saying, look up. As a pilot, before I fly, I look up. And so, boy, they're really out there working.
When you look up at the sun and you see a white haze, that is aluminum floating in the air right now, and it's coming from the aircraft.
There's a huge amount of aluminum being found because these sprays have aluminum, strontium, barium, manganese, and there's a lot of argument that aluminum is very common to be found, but aluminum is only common in a bonded form. It's not common in a free form, and we're finding high rates of free aluminum in the soil, which is not natural.
The metal compounds that are being used are environmentally dangerous. We need to be monitoring them. We need to be testing them.
Okay, these previous guys, I've watched exactly what they do, and yes, they are correct. I've seen exactly the same stuff, so ditto marks on those. You want some figures? Okay, latest water test, tested the rain. 13,100 micrograms per liter of aluminum in the rain in 2013. Normally, it should be zero. So 13,100 is pretty damn much, folks. It used to be zero. Then it was 100s in the 2000s. And then since 2010, it's into the 1000s and the latest 13,100. In the snow on Mount Shasta, pristine Mount Shasta, 61,000 micrograms per liter, four times the amount that is found in the soil up there. Where in the hell is this stuff coming from if it's not coming from the soil?
We have clouds in the sky we've never seen before.
That's just a few minutes of a longer presentation. You can go to prn.fm and hear all the testimony. One expert after the other, all scientists, pilots, people who know the truth, telling about how much barium and aluminum is getting into the air, into the soil, into our foods, into our water, and the government is not doing one single thing about it except denying it. Let's say hello now to my guest. I mentioned earlier in the program, Medea Benjamin, and Medea is a co-founder of the anti-war feminist organization Code Pink and co-founder of the international human rights organization Global Exchange. For the past 20 years, she's been one of our nation's most high-profile leaders and advocates in the movement for humanitarian and civil and social justice. In 2005, she was among other extraordinary women nominated to receive the Collective Peace Prize for their efforts to promote peace and received the Gandhi Peace Award 2014. And she's been at the forefront of protesting the war efforts of Bush and Obama and now further escalation of violence under Trump. In the past, Medea has organized humanitarian aid for war refugees in Lebanon, and she sailed on the U.S. peace flotilla to Gaza and led delegations to deliver medical supplies during Israel's Pillar of Defense campaign. And she is also the author of almost 10 books, the most recent being Inside Iran and The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran, by the way, which is a superb primer for modern Iran's history and its governance structure and life in Iran and human rights and, more recently, conflicts between Iran and other nations, notably the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia. Her website is codepink.org. Nice to have you with us today, Medea.
Hey, Gary. Good to be on your show.
We had you on the program following your trips to Iran and the release of Inside Man, so I'd like to approach this conversation from the perspective of you having been an insider with firsthand experience in the Iranian psyche and Iranians' personal attitudes towards the U.S. and the West. And since Trump came into office, he's levied heavy sanctions on the Iranian government that has adversely affected the average Iranian as well. Its oil exports have astronomically decreased, and that has been a lifeline for the Iranian economy for a long time. And that has also been a negative impact upon Assad and Syria because Iran was their major source of oil that was given to them on loan. And before the assassination of General Soleimani, there were popular protests against the Shiite theocrats ruling the country. The country was strongly divided. However, Soleimani's death, at least from my perspective, seems to have reunited the country. So from your past experience, what do you feel is going on in Iran from the Iranian public's perspective, the average person? And although the U.S. and British governments label Soleimani a monster, we are seeing how he is regarded as a hero and martyr. And what is the truth, at least from your perspective? You've been to Iran several times. The average person in the media has never been there, but acts like an expert on it. Take your time. The forum is yours.
Well, thank you. I knew from the time I was last in Iran that Soleimani was the most popular figure in the country. He was seen as a hero by people who support the Iranian government and by people who hate the Iranian government. Why? Because they realized that his work was keeping them safe. They saw the upheaval in the whole region, how groups like the Islamic State and other Sunni terrorist groups have caused havoc in the region. And you would think that Iran, which is a Shia country, would be the target of their attacks. And as soon as, whenever there were attempts to attack Iran, Soleimani was there to thwart them. And he was fighting the Islamic State in both Syria and in Iraq. So he was seen as somebody who kept them safe. There was a quote by somebody from Iran said that he was like their security blanket. This is obviously something that was totally underestimated or disregarded by the Trump administration when they murdered him.
What's it like being an average Iranian? Give us an idea of what it's like being a younger person, an older person, and then those that are supporting the theocracy. There's a big divide there, and we appreciate your perspective of how that country functions and what the day-to-day life is like.
Well, things are very difficult. Young people are, a lot of them, alienated because they are finding it hard to get decent jobs at good pay. The educational system is quite good, but then there are fewer and fewer opportunities precisely because of these sanctions. You know, there have been sanctions on Iran since the time of the revolution in 1979, but in certain times they've been stronger than others. And when Trump came in and pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal and imposed these very brutal sanctions, they have been really making it very difficult for people to find work that can cover the increased cost because of the tremendous plunging in the value of their currency. So there are a lot of young people who went out on the streets in recent months when the price of gasoline increased, and they were repressed by the government. Hundreds of them were killed. That movement was not just about the price of gasoline, but a much broader protest. Those now are, people are not going to come out on the streets for that. It has unified the people inside Iran, and it has unified them against the U.S. government. I must say, from traveling there, Gary, people in Iran love the American people. They have been so friendly to us every time we go. And they are capable, unlike many people here, of distinguishing between the American people and the American government. But they are now unified in an anti-American sentiment. And this is going to have repercussions for us throughout the whole region, where they, there is a lot of sympathy for the Shia community that is in other countries like Iraq, Yemen, Bahrain, even inside Saudi Arabia. It's a minority Shia, but they are very sympathetic towards Soleimani and Iran. So this is going to make things much more difficult for the whole issue of stability in the region.
Medea, when Bill and Hillary Clinton imposed sanctions on Iraq in the 1990s, it had devastating effects and was responsible for the deaths of thousands of children. The U.S. over the decades since the revolution have also been imposing sanctions on Iran, yet we have not heard similar cases of the cost of human life and poverty as a result in Iran. Why is that?
Well, it's a good question. You know, maybe because there's been one form of sanctions or another since 1979. But another is that, we're hearing less and less about foreign policy issues in general until they come to hit us in the head, like in this past week. These brutal sanctions aren't just on Iran, they are on Venezuela, and I recently came back from Cuba, where the sanctions are even tighter than they've been in 60 years since the time of the Cuban Revolution in 1959. The Trump administration is using sanctions as a form of warfare, and people in these countries see it as warfare, but unfortunately, we're not hearing about it, we don't know about it, we don't understand that even though our government says that humanitarian aid like food and medicines is exempt, it's not true. Banks won't take the money. Insurance companies won't insure the shipments. Shipping companies won't take the risk. But this is unknown to American people, how much we are harming ordinary citizens and how this is a form of collective punishment.
In the event of a war, Iran would be a far more formidable and equipped opponent than Iraq could ever be, and it is a huge country with a very diverse geography and a much larger population. It also has a military of almost 500,000 personnel, and I would guess, I have no knowledge of otherwise, but I would guess that they have been fully aware that Israel and the Mossad and many other countries, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, are wanting to see them destroyed, so I'm pretty sure that they would not be focused on a hard historical military operation, but rather cyber warfare. And the complications of that to other countries, and especially Israel and Saudi Arabia, could be substantial, but also they could affect us. And American military might, our military-industrial complex, and the American people and media seem to think that this is going to be a one-sided ass-kicking without giving them any potential to have thought of and work with China and Russia in preparing for the inevitability that sooner or later the Israelis are going to have a confrontation or have someone else like America as a proxy have a confrontation militarily with them. Your thoughts?
Well, there are some people who think that Trump really does have a strategy right now, and that strategy is to force Iran to pull out of the nuclear deal. And in the months ahead, as it gets closer to the elections, do what the Israelis have been pushing the U.S. to do all along, which is a military attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. Now, let's be clear, Iran has no nuclear weapons, and this deal made sure of that, but now that Iran is being pushed out of the deal, they may well go ahead. They would certainly not get nuclear weapons very quickly, but there would be enough of a brouhaha to convince the American people that we were in jeopardy and that this was attacking Iran's nuclear facilities would be an acceptable risk to keep us safe and would increase Trump's popularity just in time for the election. Now, I hope that's not a true scenario, but certainly there's a lot to think about in that Trump might do such a thing.
I appreciate your coming on and sharing these insights with us. The book is called Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The website is codepink4peace.org, codepink4peace.org. And final quick question, we're out of time. What's it like from your perspective, knowing that everything you do is monitored by the FBI, Homeland Security, the CIA, the National Security State, and they're just hoping you make some mistake somewhere so they can put you in jail as they did Chelsea Manning?
Well, I think everything I do is open because I feel like it's being watched, and I want the government to know what I'm doing right now, which is organizing against a war with Iran. We have protests all over the country today. We're planning for an International Day of Action on January 25th. And I hope your listeners will get involved with us, and they can go to the codepink.org website to find more information. And thanks so much for having me on, Gary.
Good to hear from you. We last met with Professor Robert Thurman, Ralph Nader, Gerald Salante, and you and I at the launch of the Occupy Peace and Prosperity up in Kingston. That was a wonderful day. And hopefully many of the people were there. We had 1,400 people from my radio audience came up that day. We'll join in these demonstrations that you're helping to coordinate. All the best to you, Medea.
Okay, thank you so much. Good time. Bye-bye.
Medea Benjamin. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day. When this